Hello, my name is Jakob Ihre. I'm a cinematographer and you're listening to the Go Creative Show.
Hey everyone, my name is Ben Consoli. I am a director and owner of BC Media Productions. And this is the Go Creative Show, the show dedicated to creative professionals in the video production and filmmaking industries. Today we explore Chernobyl with cinematographer Jakob Ihre. We discuss how he worked with colorists to create Chernobyl's distinctive look, their incredible interior and exterior soundstage, the most challenging shots of the series, and why a water bottle can be a valuable cinematic tool. The Go Creative Show is supported by Rule Boston Camera, Hedge.video, Shutterstock.com, Magnanimous Rentals, and PremiumBeat.com. Ooh, I am so excited to share this interview with Jakob, the cinematographer for Chernobyl. Chernobyl was one of my favorite shows of the year, for sure. It was awesome. And I know you guys liked it too, because when we posted on our social media that he was coming on, you asked us a whole bunch of questions. And that's something that we've been doing lately on the show. So follow us across all the social media channels, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, at Go Creative Show. Because what we do is we post when we have a guest coming up, and we give you an opportunity to ask your questions, and then we will ask them on the show. So it's a great way to get your voice heard on the Go Creative Show. And we certainly love hearing from our listeners. So it's easy to find Go Creative Show on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Follow us, and then you'll be up to date with what is going on and get an opportunity to ask your questions. Before we get to the interview, I just want to take a quick minute and talk about Shutterstock.com and their brand new Elements. Now, you guys are going to want to hear this because this is brand new. We haven't talked about this yet. So they recently introduced something called Elements. And these are thousands of cinema-grade video effects for filmmakers. These are blockbuster quality video effects, and they're created by industry professionals. They include 4K lens flares, transitions, video kits like smoke, fire, explosions, and more. You can check them all out at Shutterstock.com. Click on footage, go down to Shutterstock Elements, and take a look. And they've got some amazing, amazing effects here. I mean, I'm just looking right now at one called Ignite. And this is a collection of 500 plus flame and fire effects. They are practical effects. They were shot on set with red cameras in 4K resolution. And that's just one of the many kits that they have here on their site. So head over there, Shutterstock.com, click on footage, then go to Shutterstock Elements and just take a look at what they have to offer. We love them here at Go Creative Show, and I know you guys will too. All right, I am so excited to share this interview with you guys. Chernobyl is amazing. The cinematography is great, and you're going to hear all about it right now with the cinematographer, Jakob Ihre. So I'm here with Jakob Ihre, the cinematographer and director of photography for HBO's Chernobyl. Everybody is talking about this show, and we are so excited to talk to you about it, Jakob. Thanks for being on.
Well, thank you for having me.
I loved this show, and I know I'm not alone. Everybody's talking about it. It seems to have even picked up steam after all five episodes have been released. I feel like I started hearing about it more after all 5 weeks have completed. And now, you know, there's so many articles out there about what Chernobyl got right, what they got wrong. There's behind-the-scenes videos. People are really embracing this, and for good reason. It's well acted. It's beautifully shot, and I'm excited to talk about it. So tell me, how did you first get involved with this project?
It was a little bit of a fluke, I think. I had just come home from Budapest. I had come back home to Stockholm. I've been in Budapest for three, four months almost, prepping MGM movie for a long while, and suddenly that film got cancelled somehow. The actor didn't show up, kind of thing, so that got suddenly cancelled, and I flew back home and thought, okay, that was a waste of time, but I maybe also learned something from that experience to be on to plan for such a big movie. And then I came home, and suddenly Johan sent me an email. Well, actually, I had sent Johan an email, the director Johan Dreng, because we've been keeping in touch for many years, but we had never worked together. So I always, we're trying to keep in touch. And I had a film called Thelma, which was just coming out in New York. And he lives in New York, so I was telling all my friends about Thelma to please go out and support this Scandinavian film, and it's got, you know, limited release. I'm trying to, you know, promote it myself somehow, or promote the film to people to go out and see it. So he has replied and said, by the way, are you available for this show? And as and actually, we are a little bit in a hurry. Could you come to London in, if you're interested, kind of in one day or in 2 days' time? So I was sent the script, you know, a lot of secrecy around that script, and I read it on the plane somehow, or you know, it's a 500-page script, so it took some time to read, but it was such a page turner, which is kind of horrible to say about such a horrific, you know, event to read about. You don't want it to feel like a page turner, yes, in terms of entertainment, but of course it was not entertainment as such. It was more kind of fascination, and you want to know more about the horror of what actually happened. So I read that script really fast, and I guess it was some kind of an interview. I mean, I met up with Johan and the producers, and Craig Mason was also in the room. And we just had a talk. And then, of course, you know, it's a big thing to commit to in terms of time away from family and stuff. So you know, it's never, you know, the right time, or it's never, you know, every project is actually a kind of a no at first, because logistic wise to be away for such a long period.
How long were you away
before? Well, it was from Jan till August, but then of course, you know, I keep flying back home every weekend, and my family was in India at the time, so I kept flying from Vilnius to Delhi in India via Moscow on weekends and stuff. So it was a bit crazy, but you know, I think we all on the project felt that this is a project that you can't say no to. It's more than just a miniseries or a TV show, or it's something, you know, I should not say political, but it's, you know, if you're saying no to a project like this, what kind of project should you just say yes to? Should that just be projects that fit your calendar and that fit your family life, but this is a project that is beyond all that somehow, unfortunately, in some ways. But it was so important to do this, and everyone who said yes to it, you know, left everything behind and went to Vilnius, which was a wonderful place to be in, but you know still being away for a long period, but that really left us with an extremely dedicated crew who you know, really went for it.
Yeah, I mean, you can't say no to a project like this. And one of the things that struck me the most when I watched it is I thought I knew about Chernobyl. And then you watch it and you realize I didn't know anything about it.
Yeah.
I mean, that was probably the biggest reveal, is that there was so much going on that you just didn't know. And it was interesting to watch. And I'd like to hear from you the way that you prepared for this series, because the show is being praised for its realistic portrayal of the place, the time. I'm hearing a lot about how the director was almost obsessed with making it as authentic, as real as possible. What was your prep experience like for the film?
Well, like I said, we had a lot of time, even though it was, you know, 5 hours of film. We still had a lot of pre-production time. Started in December already, and then we were prepping until, I think, mid-April. So we had a lot of time to, and everyone was, of course, you know, on location, you know, preparing themselves towards this. And there was a lot to read. HBO and Craig Mason had kind of created this website for us, kind of a library and archive of everything about Chernobyl, or all the facts, all the information that Craig based his script on was in that kind of archive library that we all had access to. And
oh, wow.
And like the viewer, you get so fascinated, but you get so obsessed by it and want to know more and more. So you keep on reading, you know, from very technical stuff, how a nuclear plant works and the very intricates and details of that. And then, of course, I think the main part, the main source of knowledge was actually from this book by Svetlana Alexievich, a Belarus writer who actually received the Nobel Prize 4 or 5 years ago. And she's written this book, well, many books about the Soviet Union, and also this book called The Tears for Chernobyl,
yeah,
which is about, you know, what happened, where she's doing basically interviews or portraits of people who are telling her about the horrors that they experience during the accident and the years after. And one of the characters from the film is actually, in, you know, is based on one of them in the book of Lyudmila, the wife of the firefighter. She's, you know, very well portrayed in that book, and yeah, a lot of that material, I guess, it's in the script.
Were you allowed to go to Chernobyl to walk around? I know people are able to go and see it for short periods of time. Was that part of your prep?
Yeah, that was part of the prep, and we had different, every crew member had, or head of department had different dates when they had to go. And the day that Johan and I had to go, I think then it was canceled. It was actually a fire going on in the area. The entire forest around the plant was on fire, apparently.
Really?
Which no one, you know, there was not in the news really, or at least not in the international news, but it was on fire, and whatever that means, of course, it's not good to go when there's a fire, but also we were thinking of what will happen to all the, you know, will the radioactivity spread again through the radioactive forest, which is on fire, will that spread again, dust and pollution, but there was not much news about that. But anyway, we didn't go there, unfortunately, to show respect, but I think Johan is going then this summer. Oh, sorry, I mean next month or something like that. And of course, I will try to go as well.
I'm sorry. So you weren't able to go? No. Because during your time, that's when the fire was happening.
Exactly.
Oh, okay. Wow. So you didn't even get a chance to really be there on the ground to prepare for this.
No, we didn't, unfortunately. I mean, we had a second unit who went there to shoot. They were there for a couple of days for some shots, but in the end, no, we didn't go there, unfortunately.
Now, how much did you know about what happened at Chernobyl before this film?
Yeah, well, I was 10 years old at the time, 10, 11, and I don't remember much except that my mother gave me and my sister iodine tablets. And so I think the entire population in Sweden were given iodine tablets against this. But I don't remember much, but I know that we didn't get to eat meat or fish for many weeks or even months. We didn't eat that. And I remember, you know, from television how they slaughtered thousands of reindeers up in north, you know, where the radioactive cloud went over the north of Sweden. So they were slaughtered, but apart from that, I didn't know much, you know. And even yesterday, I talked to a friend of mine, a colleague who had done a documentary about nuclear plants in general, and he told me about that all our nuclear waste in Scandinavia has been dumped. For many years, it was just dumped in the sea, in the ocean, you know, a couple of miles away from Stockholm, and I was not aware of that. It was just dumped in concrete barrels, kind of the radioactive waste was just put in these barrels, and which was then protected with some concrete, and then it was just thrown out to the sea. And I think the Soviets or the Russians have done that for many, many years in the North Sea. So there are still things that are happening that I'm not aware of. But answer to your question, no, I didn't know much. I mean, I didn't know much at all.
How much of this was shot on location versus a soundstage or a backlot? Were you building sets?
Yeah, we were building. Our production designer Lou Cole did an amazing thing of building the exterior of the reactor 4, which was built on top of the actual studio space of the exterior of the studio, which had somehow some similar proportions as reactor 4.
Oh,
in
wow.
Chernobyl. So it was this massive exterior set, and which actually also was an interior set. So you can walk, as you walked towards the illusion of the power plant, the facade, you were expecting you would just see nothing behind it. But behind it, we had the actual studio is behind it. So we had the exterior set became an interior set.
Wow.
So the hole of the reactor, you could walk into the hole of the reactor and come out through a narrow corridor, which was like in Chernobyl. And then that narrow corridor led into the control room. So I never seen anything like it before on a film set where the exterior and the interior are merged like that. So we built that and there were a lot of studio work inside, of course, but then the main thing or the main asset we had was we had access to Ignalina. Ignalina is a power plant in Lithuania, 2 hours south of Vilnius, which is a twin plant or almost a sister plant to Chernobyl. So it's identical, except that it has only 2 reactors. Chernobyl had 4, they were building a 5th. So we were shooting there for 2-3 weeks in the backlot of this power plant, and even interiors in that power plant, which is a copy basically of Chernobyl. So that was really incredible. And that was, I guess, one of the reasons why we were shooting in Lithuania, to have access to this power plant, which is a decommissioned power plant. They are trying to shut it down, but no one really knows how to shut down a power plant. It's never been done before almost. So it takes time to extract all the uranium from it.
So you were working in a decommissioned power plant. Was everything shot in Lithuania?
Everything was shot. We did also 3 weeks in Ukraine. In Kiev, we did 3 weeks there to get some big exteriors, kind of typical Soviet exteriors. And also they did a couple of days in Moscow as well.
Okay. So you're shooting at an actual power plant that's a replica of Chernobyl. That's a really good opportunity there. My God.
Yeah. Oh, that's incredible. I mean,
was anybody working in there? You said it was decommissioned, so I'm guessing it wasn't fully staffed, or was it?
Well, it's fully staffed of a lot of security, of a lot of guards and army, because it's quite close to the border to Belarus.
Okay.
And when you walk in the corridors of Ignalina, of course, you're covered in all this, not all kind of hazmat, white overalls to protect yourself. And while you walk in there, you can suddenly see 2 men walking around in identical white suits, like the ones in the film, in the control room. And they are passing you, and they speak Russian. And you realize that these guys, who are now trying to kind of help the EU, I mean, it's part of the EU now, Lithuania, they're trying to shut it down so they're trying to help the EU to shut it down. So those guys working there, or walking past us, they had been there for 40 years almost. They were sent from Russia to build a power plant in their early 20s, and now when they are in their mid-60s, they are kind of being asked to deconstruct it or to shut it down. Hmm.
What were your visual references that inspired the look of this?
We try to stay away from visual references or one-to-one references. The references are more about an approach, how to take on this, and how should the camera be. But I mean, I remember meeting the producer Johan in London. For me, there's this photo book which always been with me since my early teens. It's a book called The Family of Man, which was it's a photo book which was made for the it was a big exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art called The Family of Man, which was one of the biggest photo exhibitions ever. I think it was in the mid-50s, and that book on that exhibition was made during, or it was kind of a reaction to the nuclear missile threat at the time in the 50s. And that this book was, or this exhibition was, hundreds and thousands of photographs, which were meant to kind of represent mankind, that we are all the same, and and you know, what are the elements of mankind? How what's the definition of being human? And these pictures show, for example, you know, they show birth, they show parenthood, they show, you know, there's a chapter about being a child, there's a chapter on war and etc. And that book has always been with me, and for every project I do, for some reason I always open that book and I always find something in it which really gives me inspiration.
What's the name of that book again? I want to try to find it and I'll put it in the notes.
The Family of Man.
The Family of Man. So this is kind of your go-to. You go here.
Yeah, it is always. It's my kind of, it's not my altar or my kind of, my point of reference for, I mean, it's really a book about humanity and how to portray humanity. And for some reason, I just realized that every picture in this book is something for Chernobyl. And you know, Chernobyl is about how to portray mankind in despair, or how to show the audience how did we react when the nuclear threat was not a threat, it was actually happening on us. So the film, also I call it the film, the miniseries and the exhibition had, you know, it was really the same thing somehow. So that was a point of reference in many ways, how to be as respectful as possible showing this event. So sorry, maybe I'm rambling here a bit, but
no.
Yeah.
As you're talking, I'm looking through the images from the book, and I mean, it's not surprising that this was your inspiration, but there's a few photos here that I've seen a million times before that I just didn't even know were part of the Family of Man exhibition. But yeah, it's this sense of despair and across almost all the photos, at least the ones that I'm seeing. And I can absolutely see the similarities of how you captured that in Chernobyl as well. It's interesting.
And of course, there's style in those photographs. I mean, many of the greatest photographers of our time, they had their kind of break, or they were picked up by the curator of the show. And Henri Cartier-Bresson became a name through the book, I think, or through the exhibition. But they all, of course, they have style, but it's less. I find that the pictures are more, not they lack style somehow, but they have a presence. And yeah, they still, and I find that the compositions and the light is, of course, it's kind of often street photography, and they often, it feels less contrived and stylized. And I guess that was some approach towards that we had for Chernobyl, that we didn't want to try to at least put a mark on it in terms of style. It was more of portraying the actors or the characters with as much respect as possible, as if the real people were standing there in front of us. So of course it was not a documentary approach. You can't say that really, but we were just trying to be as subtle and as careful as possible with the camera language.
Let's take a moment and talk about Magnanimous Rentals. Magnanimous Rentals is an equipment rental house based in Chicago, but they ship anywhere in the country. So anybody listening to this show that lives in the U.S. is going to be able to take advantage of what I am about to say. And you are going to want to, because it's big news. So first of all, you go to magwrench.com to check out their amazing inventory. But where they really shine is their prices. Now, their regular prices are great. Just their regular prices are fantastic. But then on top of that, they have things called flash discounts. Now, these are steeply, steeply discounted items, sometimes as low as 50% off, but it's limited time. That's the whole thing. So you need to check magrents.com every day. Now I'm on Magrents right now and I'm looking. One of their flash sales, and they've got many, but this is just one of them, is a set of Cook Mini S4s. It's a 6-lens set. And I just to see how much it cost, I kind of went through the process of going through the order. It's $600 for 3 days, not $600 a day, $600 for 3 days. Now, that is an amazing lens set. That's a Cook Mini S4 set in 6 lenses, okay? So That is just one of the flash discounts that are available right now at magrents.com. Now, I say right now with some caution because I don't know when you're listening to the show. I don't know when you go to magrents.com. So this one might not be available at the very second you go there, but that's not the point. The point is they're constantly changing, they're limited time, and the discounts are outrageous, and you need to go and experience it for yourself. So head over there, magrents.com, and check out what they have to offer. And if there's a flash discount, definitely take advantage of that because it's limited time, and you can get it right there at magrents.com. Now, there's so much more interview coming up, but before we get there, just a minute to talk about Hedge. Hedge is a backup software for filmmakers. You can get it over there at hedge.video. Now, the great thing about Hedge is that it's super fast. It's super easy. You can import multiple sources and send them to multiple destinations at the same time. So it's perfect for creating multiple backups on set. That's what I do. You know, my camera operators and audio techs, they give me their cards. I throw them into Hedge. I set all of them as my sources. I've got my hard drives, two of them, as my destinations. I click transfer, and I just let it go. I know it's faster than the Finder. I know it's going to be done right. I don't have to sit there and just drag things from folder to folder. No. I set it all up professionally. I click transfer, and all of my media goes where I want it to go, and I don't have to worry about it. And I have the Hedge Connect app for my phone, so when the transfer is done, I get a notification. It's perfect. It's absolutely perfect. Now, your media is the most important part of what you do. That's it. You put all that time and money into making sure that you have great-looking stuff. The media is what has to be handled the best. That's your baby. So stop using the Finder. Do this thing professionally. Head over to hedge.video/go-creative-show. You'll get a discount, a 20% off discount off the full licensing. But there's all sorts of different licensing available. So head over there and check it out. It's time to upgrade your backup software. So head over there at hedge.video/go-creative-show. What would you say was the most challenging scene or shot of the series?
Oh, I don't know really, but that's a good question. Of course, there are some technical moments which are really hard and difficult to pull off. But what I'm really proud of the film is the amount of shots we have that we shot, and also that they have, you know, that Johan has kept in the edit, are shots of people or of our main characters, how they kind of drift off the main action and just look at them, how they, there's some kind of moments of contemplation, moments of thought where the horrors are happening around them, but we are just laying often still with the camera on them as, you know, you try to read their thoughts. So there are many moments like that, I think, in the film where the film suddenly stops and we are just breathing with, or the camera is breathing with these close-ups of people. So I'm really proud of those moments. I mean, there are two shots of, in episode one, when the fireman Vasil is walking up towards the reactor and he walks up to the camera in a close-up, and then it's a cut to Lyudmila, who is not in the same space, is staring into the camera from her apartment, and the similar cuts like that of Legasov and of Pavel in episode four. So, I'm really proud of those moments.
And I think this is obviously an acting choice and a character choice, but it's something that you had to capture as well. There were a lot of moments where everything kind of slows down, and the actors are, they're looking at what happened with a sense of both fear and also wonderment. Like, there was even references to how beautiful it was before people knew what it was, and it's an odd line to draw between the two different emotions. But I think you guys did it really, really well.
Thanks. Sorry, what should I answer on that?
Not necessarily even a question. I think, it almost ties back to what you were saying with the Family of Man exhibition and the book that you have, because I'm noticing that in the photography. It's interesting to see that was your inspiration for this. It makes sense when you see it all.
Yeah, I mean, it's of course, everything is very real, but it's also surreal. I mean, we are dealing with a nuclear blast that has never happened before. And so, you know, after the blast, the world was altered. Everything was kind of upside down. The world was very different from then on.
Yeah.
And lights started to flicker, which do happen. But then also, we also try to show that somehow in our exteriors that the ambient light or even the sun or even the soft light from the sky was a little bit disrupted or disturbed somehow. I mean, we have many kind of double shadows in the film, and of course, in general, you're trying to avoid double shadows on wall because it looks lit. But we said that's okay. I mean, the world has changed now, and there are many takes we have in long scenes of dialogue where you actually see the ambience in the room is shifting from by two stops. It's going bright and it's going darker, as if the clouds are not, we are not in control anymore of our environment.
Mm-hmm.
So often there are some light changes that are happening within the scene, which I normally don't do in a scene. You try to keep the light constant in a dialogue scene, but often here we try to have it a kind of a flux or to have it in change. And you talked about the beauty. There is some beauty, and you know, the sun was there. The sun was a key factor. We draw a lot of inspiration from the Soviet murals, where you see the Soviet the worker standing with a hammer, and he's standing next to the atom, to the so-called friendly atom, which is portrayed as a sun, and this sun or this atom has even rays that are making the mural even more divine and godlike. So the sun is often there in the film I don't think anyone will think about it, but for us, it helped us to approach the scenes that we knew that in some way the sun was, or the rays of the sun was almost the rays of the atom, and the kind of the danger in a sense. And in our research, we of course read that, you know, and I remember myself that you shouldn't step out, you shouldn't go out after the blast or the weeks after the blast, you try to stay home. And especially some friends of mine, colleagues from Lithuania who were part of the crew and who was, you know, kids at the time of the blast, they were told not to step out in the sun, for some reason the sun was even more dangerous. And one of the reasons for that was maybe that they could see the invisible atom or the invisible radioactive atom in the sun, which might have just been dust particles or sand particles flying in the rays of sun. But for some reason, they maybe saw the threat in that. So
I see. So you're saying that the sun was illuminating, you know, particles that people perceived to be part of the radiation.
Yeah, some people thought of that, and so we had those two kind of elements or those two references as a leading factor when we lit many scenes, that we tried to add the sun as some kind of a threat.
I want to just go back just a couple of minutes, because you mentioned something about double shadows, and I didn't catch it. So how are you implementing double shadows in this, and why was that okay for this project?
Yes, we felt that after the blast, we felt that the world was, well, not topsy-turvy, but the world had been changed, and the elements had been interfered with. The nuclear rays had interfered with, you know, with mankind, with the flesh of mankind, but it's also interfere with nature and with the world we live in. So in that sense, everything had changed. You know, there was a taste of metal in the air, and in a subtle way, we tried to also show that the light had changed somehow. You know, of course, that's not true really, but we added, there was a lot of flicker in the reactor. Of course, the fluorescent tubes could have been flickering after the blast, and we kind of maybe enhanced that a bit while shooting and in post to make those lights flicker even more and to make the air flicker even. The same thing with the sun, that the sun was often a little bit more overexposed than I would normally do, to create the feeling that the sun was even, we can't even control the sun here. We can't expose correctly for the sun because it's, one is, has the sun been affected by the nuclear blast? Well, of course not. But then once again, what I mentioned earlier with the murals, we tried to somehow show that the atom was the sun, or the sun was the atom.
It seems like you had a lot of freedom once the explosion happened. Everything has changed, and it gave you some creative freedom to try different things with lighting. And I think it works because it gives you this sense of like uncertainty, like nothing, everything is familiar but different and off-putting.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I mean, there's, they're talking about Katya, they're talking about the roof, which is the most dangerous spot on the planet. And when they show pictures of that, of that roof in the scene, there's some photographs of the roof. The sun is actually hitting the photograph. There's some rays of sun coming through the window, hitting the photograph. So the sun is kind of present and it's kind of illuminating the photograph. And when we actually see that long one take on the roof, the sun is out there and the sun is really hot, meaning that it's really overexposed.
Yeah.
And the air is almost... there's a slight flicker in the air even. So and of course this is super subtle and we're not trying to stylize it, but it's just to give it some underlining, a tone of a tone of that we are not in control anymore. Not even the filmmakers can control this.
Now, I think it was very effective, and I wouldn't have picked up on it in that way, but I definitely picked up on the strange and odd feeling of it.
Yeah.
I'd like to talk for a couple minutes about the camera and lens package that you chose for this. Yeah. What did you shoot on?
We shot on the Alexa Mini. We had some old Cook Pancros, which hadn't been rehoused. They were really old and scratchy ones.
You went with vintage lenses for this?
Yeah, we went with vintage lenses, and I was in some way in the beginning what we didn't want to do. At first, we were thought of making something. We wanted to show the mechanics of the Soviet Union, to show the heavy machinery of the Soviet Union. Meaning, at first, we thought of using a heavy Alexa studio camera with a mechanical shutter so we would enter the world of mechanics and of something more heavy, and that would also have some heavy anamorphic lenses to make a feeling of, it's not a reference to Andrei Rublev or Tarkovsky, but to have, some way we thought we would transport ourselves to the Soviet Union easier through this heavy camera and with the with anamorphic, very distorted lenses, as we already had the idea of light, which is distorted and in flux. But in the end, we want to go more a more humanistic approach, and then we thought that the spherical lenses would be better for that, and the smaller cameras. So then at first we thought actually of using some very neutral lenses like the ultra primes, not to interact too much with the lensing on what we were shooting, to be as neutral as possible. But through testing, I think we tested 8-10 lenses and like a blind test, and we all stopped at, at test number 5, which happened to be the Cook Pancros, which had that. Which we both felt that Johan and I that looks correct for the film.
Yeah, I mean, you want to have kind of a vintage look. It is a period piece, and it has I think it has kind of like a low contrast, kind of milky sort of quality to it, which I think works great for the tone and the feel. It really gives you a mood with the way that was shot and graded too. Were there any other cameras that you were considering, or did you know right away it was definitely going to be the minis?
No, it was. I'm very used to the minis by now. you know, I always trying. I mean, we tried even to shoot on film, I think, at first, but then otherwise, I'm very used to the Alexa Minis, and I think that's a great camera, and yeah, so we went for that.
I want to talk a little bit about your relationship with the production designer, because in a film, in a project like Chernobyl, so much is reliant on production design. I mean, of course, that's the case for anything, but with this in particular, because you need to be able to represent these environments as closely as you can, and authenticity is so important. Talk to me about your relationship with that production designer.
Yeah, well, his name is Lou Call, and we are both from the National Film School in England, we didn't know each other from then, but and I don't know if that helped our collaboration, but somehow at least we had the same features. But no, but it's he doesn't become the director, of course, but he knows so much in the end. He had even more prep than I did, and he's a creator of the world, of course. He's the creator of the world that we are portraying in the end.
Yeah.
And I was so impressed by his studies and his preparations and research for this. And he was often for me the man to go to if I wanted to know more of what happened. He had enormous knowledge about Chernobyl, but also of the time and of the Soviet Union. So that knowledge that he had, he put off something amazing. Like I mentioned also earlier, some of the sets were exterior and became interior sets,
yeah,
which is quite unusual. And he's a filmmaker, and you know, there are, of course, there are many, you know, production designers are great, and there are all kinds of production designers with different backgrounds. And in Luke's case, I guess he's got a background in cinema. I mean, he's a filmmaker in that sense himself, and thinks of the story first, and not of the design as such. But he thinks of what's, you know, I find that he builds the right things because he's got knowledge about what he's portraying. And of course, the images are, the result is so much, you know, thanks to him of what he created.
Of course. You are listening to the PremiumBeat.com Song of the Week. This one's called Wildflowers by GYOM. Premium Beat is where to go for all of your royalty-free music and sound effects. If you haven't checked out their sound effects library, you are missing out, because there's a lot there. So head over to premiumbeat.com and get access to a collection of thousands of royalty-free tracks like this one for as low as $49 each. And you don't just get the single song, you get loop sets and cutdowns and stems so that you can customize the track to fit your project perfectly. It's all there at premiumbeat.com. And lastly, still got a lot more interview to go, but just a couple of seconds more for our last sponsor here, Rule Boston Camera. Strangely enough, they were actually our first sponsor way back in the day when the show just began. So they've been a supporter of us, and we've been a supporter of them from a long time ago. And you guys should be too. Rule Boston Camera is the place to go to purchase and rent all of your production equipment. Now, they've got an amazing inventory. Like, it's out of control. They've been around for over 35 years. And anytime a big Hollywood film comes through the Boston area, they're using Rule Boston Camera. So if they're using them, you should be using them too. I know that's why we use them. They got a world-class inventory, and that's great. So you're always going to find what you're looking for. But the best thing about Rule is their service. It is. Production is mission critical. And Rule has got your back all the time. You're going to get expert advice and counsel in pre-production. You're going to get technical guidance when you take the equipment out for your shoot, and they're committed to support you for your entire project. No matter where you are, no matter what you're doing, they are there to help. So what does this all add up to? Peace of mind. And isn't that what you want? Yes, of course it is. You want to get the equipment you need. You want to get the service you want. and get the peace of mind that you deserve so that you can have a flawless production. So it all starts at rule.com, R-U-L-E.com. All right, we've got a lot more interview to go, so stay right there and hear the conclusion of our interview with Jakub Ijeda. We've got a couple audience questions that are related to the color correction and your work in post. Wes Anthony from the Just Fix It in Post podcast wrote us on Twitter. He wanted to know, what measures do you take to make Russia appear bleak and dreary before it goes into color grade? So I guess what we can discern here is trying to figure out, what are you doing before color grade that gives it that look?
Well, I had shot a documentary in 2002. I was in Odessa in Ukraine, not far from Kiev. And I was there shooting a film in the city Odessa. And that experience, I realized that that experience and the way that film looked, it was shot on 16. And I shouldn't say it was a stylized documentary, but it was more like everything was shot on tracks and on dollies, that documentary, and almost looked more like a fiction film. And the colors of that film really had an impact on me, in the sense that for me, that the world that we portrayed there in Odessa and in Ukraine, that became my template or my norm of the way I saw Ukraine. Hmm. And that film was shot on 16, and I remember we shot it with a storm filter, which was a very popular filter at the time, kind of a blue-green-gray filter.
It's called a storm filter?
Yeah, storm filter, I remember.
And what did it do?
Well, we thought that we are shooting now in Odessa. No one knows how Odessa looks like. People who see this will see Odessa, the film. It's called Odessa. When they see it in festivals, they don't know. They will think it looks like this. And so we thought we could portray it with a kind of green bluish cast. Hmm. And when I went through the different LUTs in the ARRI library in the camera, I suddenly found something that I felt, oh, this looks like Odessa. This LUT makes it look like the way that 60mm feature documentary looked like. Huh. I had the app of those LUTs, and suddenly I felt, wow, that's the one. And then, so we had that LUT put on, while we were shooting on the rushes. And that was a very strong template and reference when we went back in the grade. Then we had we had that LUT, and then we had another LUT, kind of a DSAT, a little bit less green LUT, but it was slightly more DSAT. So those two LUTs were with us, and that was the main reference in the grade as well. We worked with a very, very gifted, experienced colorist called Jean Clément Sauret in London, who helped us with the grade, and we had a great collaboration with him. But we were always somehow trying to remember how those rushes looked like. In some cases, it might have looked too green sometimes or too desaturated sometimes, but they were very good guiding line for us.
Is there anything that you do other than applying a LUT that contributes to that look? I mean, are you lighting a certain way so that the LUT is the most effective?
Well, we didn't have any live color grading, and we shot with all these old lenses, which are not calibrated. They all have different, different warmth and colds in them.
Yeah.
So I was almost live grading through, not through a proper live grading, but I was giving out Kelvin temperatures and different plus magenta and plus green to the camera assistants to tweak and to kind of grade the image and match them with the other cameras and lenses. And so, yes, in my control, I have, I play a lot around with color temperature and with a plus C and plus green. And then, like I said, many of our sets had the artificial lights of fluorescence, and then we also had the sun coming in. So it was a lot of, mixed temperatures. But also at the same time as it was very mixed and different temperatures, we also wanted to try to make it feel like one, and it shouldn't, and of course the desaturation and the softness helped those very contrasting colors to merge more and make it somehow less stylized in a sense, or make them pop less. So yeah. I don't know if I answered that well.
No. I certainly think you did. And it was interesting because most of the questions that we got when I mentioned you were going to be on the show was about the color grade. People seem affected by this color grade.
Yeah, but at the same time, I mean, I was in some relatives' house last weekend, and I think I saw for the first time I saw Chernobyl on someone else's television, and of course. I'm so grateful that, you know, Chernobyl can be seen by so many people in their houses and you don't have to go to the cinema to see it. But then I also realized the downside of it, that it, you know, people see it on some very old LCD monitor or yes. TV screen and it looks horrendous. I'm really curious how most people see Chernobyl, you know, so because... it's not a DCP, which is nowadays quite accurate to what you did in the grading, but now I don't really know. But I guess the iPads and the good computers show quite a good image, but still, you know.
I know you really can't trust people's TVs, especially if you just buy one from the big box store and throw it up on your house. It's yeah. overly saturated. It looks terrible. You got to do some work on that. But at least, you know, tablets and computer screens are generally, I mean, they're not calibrated perfectly, you know, one-to-one, but you can get a pretty consistent look from there. So you can have an idea what people are going to see. I want to talk for our last couple of minutes about your other work. You know, I go to your site and I see, you know, great commercial work. And I saw some of the work that I really gravitated towards the most was your car commercials. You've done really beautiful work for Volvo and Audi. And
thank you.
Yeah, and we haven't really talked much on this show about, you know, the way to perfectly craft cinematography for car commercials. And I'd love to kind of hear your approach to them.
Well, my approach, I don't know, really. It's a good question. I mean, the approach is that I don't do that many car commercials. And when I do them, or when I've been fortunate to work with directors who don't do that many car commercials either, in some way, that they're super excited, these directors, and I think I have three car commercials on my site, which all been shot in cities, which we have kind of discovered. I mean, one was shot in Gothenburg with this French-Lebanese director duo who were super excited to be in Gothenburg. It was raining and cold, and I was back in my hometown after, you know, 25 years. So we all got excited by that. And there's another one we shot for Audi in Munich, and we had to make it look like Shanghai, I think. And with the director who felt also very fortunate to do this car commercial. So, and so that's a kind of a drive to make something good. I think that we are all very enthusiastic and driven to do this. And when you get them,
I guess how do you approach them in the way that, you know, yes, there's going to be people in them, but the star of the show is the car. Is there any changes? Is there anything that you need to think about when approaching a car commercial that we may not know? We may be surprised to hear.
Yeah, I mean, I shouldn't say this, I guess, but you know, you think less of the car and you try to focus on the person driving it. And some of the car commercials I've done have been very focused on the car, of course, but also of the, you know, of the person, often been kind of characters. In the Volvo commercial, is a very gifted Swedish conductor, and she's very fascinating to portray and to see her journey in the city. So you know, you focus on that, and coming from a background of doing a lot of documentaries and features, features where there's a lot of focus on the individual, you kind of transport yourself into fiction mode, that you almost forget you're shooting a commercial. You think you're doing a piece of fiction.
Yeah.
So it's, yeah.
Is there something different in the way that you light for a car?
Well, I light for the environment, and hopefully it goes with the car as well. You know, I light for the story, and of course you have to make sure that the car looks good, and you have all the tools to make the car look good also. But your starting point is to make sure the environment is correct, and if that's shot well, then often the car fits quite well into that. But there are some great experiences shooting commercials. You try different equipment you've never done before. There's an Audi commercial for the Chinese market where we were fortunate to work with this big gravity-like LED screens, like a back projection. And I never worked like that before. And for me, that was a milestone of, standing next to a car in a studio and you shoot through the window of the driver and you have the feeling that you're moving around in Chernobyl, sorry, in Shanghai, not in Chernobyl, fortunately. And those are the moments where where you are really lucky. You can try these new techniques, and the next week you might be in Oslo, in Norway, shooting a car commercial or a car scene with a family in a car. But of course, you can't maybe afford these enormous LED panels, and then you just project with a simple video projection projector. You project a background plate that you have shot the day before with your iPhone, and suddenly you get and that works as well. So
that LED plate screen that you're talking about, that was like, instead of having a green screen and putting a plate on there, you just had a large LED screen that were your exteriors.
Yes, we had three enormous LED screens that the team in a French team had shot in Shanghai the day before at night, and had kind of transferred those rushes to us to have them displayed on this enormous LED screens. Just the way they shot Gravity, I guess. So the LED screens, of course, gave the light onto the actor and gave us the reflections in the windows, and was also the background for us. And similar technique we used in like I said, in Oslo, but then we just used it the old-fashioned way that you did back in the times of Hitchcock, where you had a back projection.
Yeah, it's like the next evolution of that. And actually, you're the only other person that has ever been on the show to talk about it. And the first person was the visual effects coordinator for Gravity. And however many years ago that was. And it was... cutting edge technology at the time, and people, it's still not really employed that much because it's super expensive. But it's an interesting way to do it because you get all the natural reflections and the natural colors. Like it's great.
Yeah. But it's interesting also that in the end, if you're doing a commercial, you get away with more, you don't stay that long on an image. So you can actually pull it off with, 1% of the price by shooting it, the old style way of with an iPhone, and you project that onto a white cotton sheet, and then you have your back projection.
Yep.
But you can only do that if it's a commercial where you stay not that long on a shot.
Is that really how you would do it? You'd just grab your iPhone and grab the plate and use that for color?
Well, no, I wouldn't do that. But in some instances it worked. In this case, it was a night shoot, or it was a night background. So you get away with things, I guess.
Oh my God! Well, we like to ask our guests this one last question, and you may need a minute to think about it. I should have given you this question ahead of time, but I'm curious: is there something in your is there some piece of gear, big or small, expensive or inexpensive, just a piece of gear that you have to have with you on all your projects? Something that you just have to have. Now, some people have said, it's something small, like an arm that they really like, or a filter that they love. Is there something that you just have to have with you at all times? A little piece of gear.
No, that's changes quite often.
It's yeah. Kind of the, but what's your gear of choice right now? Just a little.
Right now, I left my spoons behind. For a while, it was the spoons, but I always got caught in the security by beeping because I left the spoon in my back pocket from the shoot the
what
night
do you
before.
Mean? What is it?
Well, a tablespoon. But you know, to put in front of the lens and to create different reflections. But now in the last months, it's been a water bottle. And talking about those car commercials, many two of those, or actually all three car commercials, have been shot with a simple little water bottle with a little bit of water in it in front of the lens.
And
that's something just like a spoon, a little water bottle with some water on your. Water inside, it's kind of, you can fit it in your back pocket, so when you're shooting something you can always bring that out. You know, you don't have to bring out your Samsonite little briefcase, which you might have forgotten at the hotel. But this water bottle or the spoon is something so easy to, you know, it's something very easy you can just bring out from your pocket, and you can create some very nice images for that, or textures and reflections with that. So I guess right now it's a small Aquafina bottle.
That's crazy. So you just throw it in front of the lens and you just get like cool, interesting reflections like that.
Yeah. And what's nice with the water is that when you are shooting, if you're inside the car and you're in the backseat shooting kind of three quarter of the driver, while you're having this water bottle in front of the lens, the water is moving with the car moving. So you're getting this, you don't get a fixed reflection or a fixed flare. The reflection or the refractions, they keep on moving. You know, the water is moving, so it's quite a nice look.
Look at that. I think you're the first person to suggest or to say that their favorite piece of gear doesn't cost anything at all. Exactly. That is incredible. Hey, we like that. We like that here too. Now, I'm sure if people are listening to this show, I suggest that you take some interesting shots using a spoon or a water bottle, send it in to Go Creative Show. We'll put a post about it to see what interesting creations you make with these simple tools. I love stuff like that.
That's good.
Of all the equipment out there, it comes down to something so simple. I think that's neat. Well, I can't thank you enough for being on Go Creative Show and talking about your experience here with Chernobyl.
Yeah, thank you.
For people that want to learn more about you, where can they go online?
Well, they can go online. Well, try to go to IMDb and look at the feature films that I've shot since what is it?
Are you on Instagram?
I'm not on Instagram, but please try and go and see the movies. See them on iTunes or on Netflix or somewhere.
No,
I'm not on Instagram.
See his work, jokobihre.com. You can go and check out his website, see his work there. And of course, Chernobyl on HBO. I'm just going to say Jacob again, because I cannot make it work any other way. But
no,
thank you so much for being on the show. We really appreciate it. And we'd love to have you back for your next big project.
Yeah, well, thank you, Ben. I'd love to come back.
There he goes. Cinematographer and director of photography of Chernobyl, Jakub Ijeda. Thank you so much for being on the show. I also want to thank two people behind the scenes that make the show happen. We've got our producer, Connor Crosby. You can find him at ignitionvisuals.com. And Matt Russell. He mixes masters and makes the show sound so good. You can find him at gainstructure.com and on Twitter at gainstructure. And while you're on Twitter, you can tweet us. Let us know what you think of the show. Ooh, and join our Facebook, our Instagram, and of course our Twitter. Follow us there, because you'll get an opportunity to ask upcoming guests your questions. How about that? Now, I also own a production company and I'm a director. So if you guys want to see behind the scenes videos and how-to videos and photos from all of our productions, head over to my Instagram at Ben Consoli. Now, of course, our sponsors, Hedge.video, Rule Boston Camera, Magnanimous Rentals, Shutterstock, and Premium Beat. Without these people, the show wouldn't exist. So support those that support us. And we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.